morning. You're with the Country Breakfast on RN. I'm Edwina Farley. A dire warning this week from the University of Melbourne about the future effects of climate change on our food.
Heat stress has a very real and immediate impact on the dairy industry and its ability to recover from that. So those cows not only crash in their production, but they don't recover very readily and they very seldom get back up to the peak levels of milk production they were at beforehand.
A great range of opinion for you this morning on how climate change and technology will shape our future menu. First, though, for the big stories in rural news, Tony Allen's with us. And Tony, some very devastating effects from Cyclone Pam in the Pacific.
Yes, the latest we have from Vanuatu is pretty terrible because 80% of the country's people, that's about 200,000 of them, are subsistence farmers. They grow their own food and now is not a good time for them. The Vanuatu government says all the country's banana trees, most of the coconut palms have been felled. The vegetable crops have either been flooded or uprooted. Thousands of chickens and pigs have been killed. Their shelters have been destroyed. All in all, it's a huge disaster. And the fishing industry is in terrible trouble as well. Australia runs agricultural aid programs in Vanuatu to help families grow things like sandalwood, native nuts and cocoa. Tony Bartlett from the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, which runs some of these programs, says the trees will recover quite quickly, but the coral reefs will take longer to repair.
The aquaculture facilities that they'd established, which are located very close to the seafront, will have taken quite a hammering because of the storm surges. It tends to destroy the coral reefs. They eventually come back, but it might take 10 or 15 years for them to recover to the state that they're highly productive again.
And things aren't too good for the coffee growers either. Now, the island of Tana, which is one of the worst hit, has been growing coffee for more than 150 years and they were expecting their best ever crop this year. 25% of those beans are imported by Australian coffee roasters too. So the Tanna Island Coffee Project's Mike Pohl says there are about 600 to 900 farmers growing coffee on Tanna on small plots, and it looks like only about 30 to 40% of the crop can still be harvested.
When they had the last cyclone, coffee was one of the plants that survived because it's a very carbonated plant. It's very, very hard. So it can withstand a lot. The coffee will bounce back very quickly. It's a taprooted plant, so even in the ash, which is what Tanna is, it'll be deeply rooted. There will be breakages, but it will spring back like a weed pretty quick.
And we should mention the ABC is working with the Red Cross to raise money to help in Vanuatu, and you can find out how to donate or more about that at abc.net.au/appeals. Now, some work on one of our most isolated farms.
Christmas Island in the Indian Ocean is best known for its immigration detention centre. Also has a phosphate mine and currently imports 95% of its produce, and you can spend $15 or so on a cauliflower or a lettuce there. It's outrageously priced. And a bloke called Mark Bennett, he lives on the Sunshine Coast now in Queensland, but was raised on Christmas Island. He's got a company called Hidden Garden Farms, which has a 21-year lease on 54 acres of Crown land on Christmas Island. They're going to grow fresh fruit and vegetables there. Other things too. I think they're going to raise chickens, raise honey, do whatever they can to create fresh produce on that island. The new farm should lower the residents' sky-high food bills.
If you go to a restaurant on Christmas Island and you get a steak and chips and salad, it's often joked that the most expensive part of the meal was the salad. Spot prices for things can really soar, and there has been an incidence where people pay $19 for an iceberg lettuce. You know, it's not uncommon for a family to spend $500 on a weekly fresh fruit and veg bill.
They are amazing figures. Looking at the meat side of that plate full of meat and salad, there is an inquiry into the red meat processing industry.
Yes, well, some farmers think we're paying too much for red meat as well compared to what they get at the farm gate. Senators this week voted to establish a six-month inquiry into the way processors and livestock agents and cattle buyers treat the farmers in the red meat industry. It's partly prompted by a dispute over the selling methods at the new high-tech Barnawatha sale yards in Victoria, where there was a big dispute about whether the cattle should be weighed before or after they were sold, because it did make a difference to how much farmers got paid. This Senate inquiry is going to look into market power in the meat industry, possible misuse of market power, allegedly by processors, and how cattle were sold at sale yards. A wide range of things, really. Quite an open inquiry. And Victorian National Senator Bridget McKenzie says consumers, farmers and meat processors are all being asked to come forward with their concerns.
And if something's going wrong in the way the competitive market is operating, or is regulated or is not regulated, then we need to absolutely make that right. What we do know is that consumers are paying exorbitant prices, some would say, for their red meat, and that is not being reflected at the sale of the carcass at the sale yard.
It's not an exorbitant price, but is it too cheap, the old dollar a litre milk?
Yes, yeah, sort of the opposite in dairy, where the $1 a litre milk is becoming more and more popular. More than half the milk bought by Australians now comes at $1 a litre. The average price we pay for milk now is down to $1.55 a litre. It used to be fairly much higher than that. And John Droppett from Dairy Australia says this trend is also changing the type of milk we're buying.
The move by consumers effectively away from modified milks, which another name for reduced fat and no-fat milks, towards full cream milk. It's got a lot to do with discounting as well, and the fact that the private label products or the biggest discounts tend to be towards the full cream end of the spectrum, and that also influences people's choices to some extent as well.
Just shows you can talk all about trendy low-cal milk and how good it is for you, but if the full cream milk's cheaper, people will buy it.
Yeah, I prefer it, to be honest, personally. Something that's, tickled the fancy, you could say, of the Prime Minister this week has been onions.
It's certainly tickled his palate. A week ago, Tony Abbott was announcing a freight subsidy in Tasmania. And in doing so, to illustrate the assistance to Tasmanian produce that this freight subsidy would achieve, he bit into a raw onion. That went viral on social media. And Onions Australia, the body that represents growers, got very excited and said this was a marketing dream because all over the world they were looking at pictures of Tony Abbott biting into a raw Tasmanian onion. The chief executive of Onions Australia, Lishel Earl, said this was a chance to convince Mr. Abbott to urge Australians not to buy imported onions, which had flooded the market earlier in the year.
We're genuinely surprised, but delighted about the airplay Aussie onions are getting at the moment, particularly in the wake of drama surrounding US imports. I will be fronting up to the Prime Minister's office with a cooked meal featuring onions so that he doesn't actually have to eat a raw one. And hopefully we can just have a bit of a chat about the importance of the Australian onion industry.
And indeed she did on Thursday. She went to Mr. Abbott's office with a sweet potato, onion and feta quiche, which he did eat, but before he tasted that, he bit into another raw onion.
Oh, gosh.
And that got everyone very excited. It's now become the Raw Onion Challenge.
Excellent.
And is going all over the world. So don't expect the frenzy to end anytime soon.
Well, I won't be pulling any such stunts on the program this morning, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tony Allen with the week's Rural News. Find those stories online at abc.net.au/rural.
Hi, Fran Kelly here. Next week on Breakfast, we're broadcasting from Parliament House in Canberra. It's the final sitting week before the Coalition's all-important second budget, a critical test of the Treasurer's economic vision and of the Prime Minister's leadership. And unlike the budget, we will have a surplus of interviews and it will be anything but dull. Join me and the RN Breakfast team on Monday from 6.
Edwina Farley with you for A Country Breakfast, where we always love hitting the road with our rural reporters. This week, a project that's helping to protect baby turtles from hungry goannas on a Queensland beach. We're picking flowers that are good enough to eat and meet some would-be Aussie farmers, international students who are studying to stay in Australia. We also check out a young bull named Chivalry, being prepared for Beef Australia 2015.
Now, if I saw any other bull, I'd say this one looks pretty manly.
Yeah, he is. And he always stands like that. He's a real showman, and I think they have to have those qualities in them for people to notice, for him to be noticed in a ring.
Preparing stud animals for Australia's premier beef expo in a moment. But first stop today, a beach in southeast Queensland, where volunteers are stepping up their campaign to protect endangered turtles.
It's an aluminium cage. We call it a cage, but it's not really a cage. It's shaped like one. The idea of it is it's about a metre square, and then it has these sides that are 20 centimetres deep. It sits upside down so that the sides are pointing down into the sand, and then the flat surface is on the top.
And if it all goes according to plan, this inverted aluminium cage will give the turtle eggs inside this nest some much-needed protection.
It's buried completely under the sand by about 10, 15 centimetres of sand, so that the goannas, of course, couldn't dig through the top. The sides mean that the goannas can't dig in from the sides as well, unless they're going to dig 30 or 40 centimetres down. So it's proved to be a very successful deterrent from goannas being able to predate the nests.
Hello, I'm Eliza Rogers on secluded Wreck Rock Beach, just north of Bundaberg in southeast Queensland. This is a favoured nesting site of the endangered loggerhead turtle. Unfortunately, it's also home to some very hungry goannas that love nothing more than feasting on the eggs. I'm here with two veterans of the Turtle Care Volunteers Queensland group, Nev and Bev McLaughlin. This dedicated couple has spent the past 45 years monitoring turtle nests along this stretch of coastline. In fact, it was their observations about an increase in goanna numbers that led to this latest deterrent trial led by researchers from the University of Queensland.
Okay.
One of the other methods used is putting pepper or like chili powder around the nest. How much does that help?
We're not really sure yet. That's in just initial stages. That's part of the university's project and just one of the methods they're trialling. I don't think they've had a great amount of success. It'll be an easy method. If we can find something like pepper or chili powder that is going to keep the goannas away, it's going to be a very easy way to deter them.
There's no clear reason for the rise in goanna numbers, but it's thought it could be a flow-on effect from a fox baiting program in the 1970s. With no predators, goanna numbers have exploded. We're just walking back to the campsite and we've just crossed a goanna track. How common is it? How much evidence do you see of the goannas around here?
Yeah, no, there's a lot. You can walk through any of the tracks and you'll find that there's zigzag with the goannas, and it's probably more so early morning and late night. And then down on the beach, once you start doing your patrols, they're just all over the beach. They're doing patrols up and down, and they'll walk along and start digging anything that they can find.
Have you ever caught one in the act
of digging up a nest?
Oh, yeah. We've actually got photo evidence of them digging. Last year when we had the cameras out for the project, we've actually got one of a goanna over a nest for over an hour trying to work its way to get through this metal mesh. And it wasn't going to, but it was persistent for an hour.
Well, speaking of hatchlings, we have a bucket of loggerhead hatchlings. I believe you collected this morning or late last night. So, Bev, just tell me, how many do we have in here and what's their story?
Okay, the first nest I came across this morning, I started digging through it and just found little groups of two or three hatchlings as I was going through and got right down and then found the mass of eggs and then intermingled through them were 22 little hatchlings that had actually broken through the egg, got their head out, got their flippers out, and then that's as far as they'd gone. They'd all passed away. But the nest where it was laid was in the really soft shell grit, and it's really hard to dig. Sort of you'd go in and you take one flipper out or one handful out and three more will fill in. And I think that's what happened with these guys. They lost the rest of the pack and consequently they couldn't all come up at the one time. So by me going out and doing my morning shift, I've managed to save their lives. We'll let them go tonight, and hopefully, if it wasn't meant to be, then they'll be the food and hopefully save something that's a little bit more healthy than what's out there now.
We certainly don't make a habit of bringing hatchlings away from the beach at all, but because these were caught in the nest, would have died in the sand had we not brought them out, we couldn't release them at the time because it was full daylight and there's goannas everywhere on the beach. So we're just keeping them here during the day today, and they'll be released tonight when it's dark and a little bit safer for them.
Does it affect when they come out and then they make their way to the water and they're imprinting and kind of familiarising themselves with their magnetic field so they can return years later, does it affect them if they are being taken away from the beach?
We hope not. There's been trials done on things like that, and as long as we keep them away from all metal substances, aluminium safe, but anything that is magnetic will upset their magnetic field. So trials have been done with various things, but we make sure we don't put them near metal things. We don't carry them in vehicles and keep them out of, or just keep them in plastic and as little interference as possible.
They're not released at the water's edge, they're released up near the dune level so that they've got the full length of the beach to walk till they get into the water, so that's where their magnetic field comes into play.
They're so cute.
Nev and Bev have been part of a long list of successes since they started volunteering as a married couple in the late 70s, continuing Nev's work dating back to 1970. Over that time, the Wreck Rock area has been included in the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park, and fishermen have had to install turtle excluder devices on their trawl nets. It's important to the couple that turtles are protected for future generations, and Bev says their children share the passion.
In 1983, had a daughter on the 21st of December. I got out of hospital with her on the 28th and she was on the beach doing her runs on the 29th. So she is the youngest researcher. She's been doing that ever since, and she's only missed the last four seasons, and that's because she's now has her own family and they're currently living in Tampa doing their turtle research over there. Our son was born on 4 years later on the 5th of February, so I was a very pregnant lady doing research that season. So it's pretty involved. If someone's not doing something to protect our turtles, they're not going to be there for our children and our children's children to see them, because they are a very endangered species, and we're just trying to do everything we can to make sure that they're going to be around for the future.
Come on, old fella, you want to come up?
Meet Chivalry, a Brahman bull and the pride of stud breeder Lorena Jeffress.
Why are you out in the sun?
See, he's a skirt bull. You have a look at him, he's a nice.
Now, if I saw any other bull, I'd say this one looks pretty manly.
Yeah, he is. And he always stands like that. He's a real showman, and I think they have to have those qualities in them for people to notice, for him to be noticed in a ring. You know, that's what I meant when I said before, they've got to stand out from the others, and he always presents himself. He always stands really well. No, I really like him.
And Lorena hopes the judges at this year's Premier Cattle Expo, Beef Australia 2015, will think that he's pretty special too. Hello, I'm Hayley Renault, and I'm at the Elrose Brahman Stud near Cloncurry in northwest Queensland. Chivalry is just one of a handful of bulls and heifers Lorena will be taking to Rockhampton in May for the triannual show.
Is it once every so often you find one that has that showmanship in his blood?
Yes. He's the one I've sort of got most hopes for at Beef. He's going to be. They're all going to be in the junior classes, but the others, they just haven't got that air about them. He's the main one, but I mean, you have to go with others. So you know, judge mightn't like what you like.
Elrose has been in the stud business for more than a century, but stopped holding on-property bull sales 4 years ago. That's why it's so important for the Jeffress family to take their best stock to competitions like Beef Australia 2015.
If you're in the beef business, you have to be at it just to keep your name there. I think, you know, we used to have sales here, and once you sort of stop, I think 5 minutes later you've forgotten. So you've got to just keep, you know, we may not be in the spotlight now, but you've got to keep your name out there so people can still see you there, because we sell our bulls in the paddock now. We can see where we're at compared to other people, and they can see us as well. I enjoy it. We're there down there for about 10 days. We look like a travelling circus. We take the gooseneck and live in that, but it's all good.
Picking the right animals can be the difference between coming home dressed with a rainbow of sashes or returning empty-handed. They need personality plus, enough confidence not to spook easily, and have good rapport with their leader.
As long as they've got the right mindset, they have to be like a horse, cool, they're the ones that listen to you and respond. If it's mad, well, you know, I don't even bother starting. There's no point. They don't want to be beside you. They don't want to be near you. That's the whole point of it. I mean, they can do what they like, but, I mean, they only want to be with you because they trust you and they like you.
Do you form a special bond with the ones that you get a bit of training time in with?
Oh, yes. I love them. I'm hopeless.
The qualities of any good bull or heifer can be passed down from mother to daughter and father to son as well. Miss Didor won at the last beef meet, and Lorena has high hopes for her daughter, who's taken the same name.
This one here, Miss Didor, is out. This is the one out of the... her mother was the one. You're right. She knows you're different, eh?
Yeah, she can see me.
All right, girl. This heifer here, her mother won calf champion the last beef, so it's exciting. She'll go down now and try to do the same as her mother. Her mother's got a calf on her now, and I hope to have it for next year. It's going to be the World Brahmin Congress next year, and if she's still going, she'll have a calf at foot, and her young brother will end up being a junior one next year. So that's exciting when you can keep up families. That's what I enjoy.
Yeah, a bit of history there, and I saw her mum's photo hanging on the wall, so if she wins, will you put a frame up with this girl in it?
Definitely, yeah. She's a nice heifer. She's lovely, quiet, just enjoys it. And, of course, she had a couple of shows as a calf on her mother. We went down to Sydney last year. She got reserve champion, so it was nice. So she sort of knows all the drill about the shows, so that's probably why she's placid too, so it won't be such a big deal for her. But the bulls have never been to anything.
It won't be long until they're all taken away for a practice run, and then it's off to Beef 2015 in Rockhampton for their final test.
Hi, baby. How are you going? Hey, girl.
And good luck to Lorena Jefferis with her team of show cattle, including that young bull Chivalry. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, overseas students with a love of farming are studying to stay in Australia. And we're picking flowers that are good enough to eat.
I'm just packing our edible flowers to go off to the market. I'm packaging up the marigolds at the moment. I drive them down to the Melbourne wholesale market, and they get sold and distributed off the market floor to providors and greengrocers, and then from there distributed to high-end restaurants and specialist fruit and veg shops.
We're often reminded to stop and smell the roses, but do you ever eat them? Edible flowers and leaves are a growing craze on the Aussie food scene, and grower Lauren Richardson is being kept busy trying to keep up with demand.
Ones that are in season at the moment is rocket flowers, cornflower, rose petals, a lot of the English cottage varieties, so things like viola and pansies, geraniums, yeah, the list goes on.
Hello, I'm Margaret Buren on a farm at Glen Lyon near Daylesford in central Victoria. Today is harvest day at Forage Flavour, and Lauren and her team have just finished picking and packing 300 punnets of edible flowers and leaves.
It's just grown. We started with about 5 different varieties, so the rose petals, the violas, the pansies, snapdragons and nasturtiums. And then we've just added more aromatic and more impressive flowers like the fennel, like the pineapple sage and lavender, and more aromatic and herbal varieties that really enhance the dish rather than just a decorative and improve the appearance of the dish.
Now, you supply some of Melbourne's most renowned restaurants, including Heston Blumenthal's newly opened Fat Duck, which I suppose was a big one in the headlines for foodies around Melbourne. I can imagine there'd be a lot of secrecy involved in what they're using. Can you just disclose some of the ingredients that they're using and what they're using to make?
Unfortunately, I haven't been lucky enough to dine at the Fat Duck. I don't know what they're using it for. I can't disclose the varieties. I know Flowerdale Farm do send oyster leaves in. So there is a little bit of competition in the edible flower industry now. There's more and more growers getting involved. So we all like to have our little varieties that nobody else has yet and get first to market with those varieties. And yeah, we're doing new things all the time. And I've got another customer over in Western Australia who's almost every week ringing up saying that a chef's asked him for another variety. And so that I'll test the variety, see if it's viable, see how long the season is, and whether or not I agree and think that it will be something that's popular. But also a lot of chefs are really responsive to what's in season, and they rely on the growers for information on what they can put on the menu and how long it can go on their menu for and what's suited to different dishes as well. So they might ring me up for they need a small purple flower and I'll give them a list of what might be available.
And what's hot at the moment?
Well, Viola is always hot because it's a beautiful, cute little flower. But just coming into season, we have what's called Tropical Blaze or Pineapple Sage. So if you crush this in your hand and smell it, it's got
it smells like pineapple.
Yeah, it's got a real tropical scent to it. So that flavour can come out in dishes. It's great for fruit salads, and it's got a striking scarlet tube-like flower that's quite visually impressive on the dish as well.
What do you think will be the next hot thing in the edible flower market?
Well, I'm a huge fan of fennel flowers. They look beautiful. They're on a frong and they have these bright yellow, tiny little flowers on the end of them, and they've got the most sensational aroma and taste, and they're well suited to the cocktail market. So to create an aniseed cocktail, or suited to desserts as well, like an aniseed ice cream. Whenever I show chefs the smells and the taste of the flowers, they're really surprised. So snapdragons, for example, have a really strong melon flavour, and you can really extract those flavours out. I made a Viola syrup, and obviously I've made rose syrups as well, so I think there's great potential in the dessert and cocktail industries for edible flowers.
Is there any sign that it may be just a passing fad or one of those foodie crazes?
It does worry me that it could be, but things like lavender, rose petals have been used in cookings for centuries. I think if it's used more as an ingredient and not so much as just a pretty garnish on the plate, there'll be much more stability in the market. And I think that's probably what's going to see them last in the market, if they are used for their qualities other than just decorating a dish.
Students are pushing a mob of crossbred ewes up the race here at the Riverina TAFE College in Wagga Wagga in the southwest of New South Wales. They're heading towards a small tent. And inside the tent, professional scanner Cole Robertson checks on his ultrasound monitor to see if the ewes are pregnant, carrying single lambs or twins.
We're looking for the twins so we can separate them. There's one up there.
There's one down here?
Yeah.
Also in the tent is Certificate 4 Agriculture student Marina Van Aken.
If we can separate the twins, we can feed them better, especially if it's dry weather. And take the empties out.
There's at least one there.
That's right.
Marina comes from Holland, and like many other overseas workers with a passion for farming, is prepared to go to great lengths to call Australia home. To gain permanent residency, these students now need to upgrade their skills and complete a diploma in agriculture. Hello, I'm Larissa Smith. This demand for diplomas is filling TAFE College courses and could provide a stable workforce for local farmers in the future.
I first came out to Australia in 2009. I worked at a sheep station near Broken Hill. So I went back to, because I was still at uni, back in Holland. And so I decided to come back the year after that. And again the year after that. I'd always been interested in agriculture, but agriculture in Europe is really based, like shed-based. So that's not the kind of agriculture I wanted to be in. So as soon as I got to Australia, I discovered that it's quite a different kind of agriculture. And so I was quite interested in that. And so I decided to find out if I wanted to stay here like long term, and came out for 2 years on the working holiday visa and discovered that I really liked agriculture. And so that's when I decided to go and do TAFE course.
Was it an easy choice for you to make?
Yes, it was. And I thought about doing egg science, but I wanted to do hands-on stuff. And TAFE is perfect for that because they actually teach you how to vaccinate an animal or all the hands-on daily stuff. And you probably wouldn't get that when you're doing an egg science degree. So it was a very conscious decision. I'm going to do a TAFE a diploma, yeah.
So you've been preg testing today?
Yeah, it's really nice just to actually be able to see, like, the spinal cord and the ribs and trying to see whether there's one or two in there. Yeah, it was a new experience. I'd seen it because I worked at a vet clinic. I'd seen it done, but I'd never done it myself.
So yeah. Perhaps a new career?
Well, possibly, yeah, yeah.
And there are other similar stories at this campus. Justin Moore was a bricklayer in Londonderry in Northern Ireland before he decided to make the move to Australia. He's been working on a cropping farm near Finlay and hopes to manage his own farm one day.
Yeah, I'm doing, I've done my Cert 4 in agriculture last year, and then for immigration they want a diploma, so I have to do it this year.
So when you mean for immigration, is that for you to stay in the country a bit longer?
Yeah, that's for me to get permanent, get sponsored by my employer and then become permanent resident. The immigration said Cert 4 was enough last year. Then they changed the rules and said they want their diploma. I have to come and do it. Pretty expensive for each course. It's 11,500.
But you obviously really want to stay in the country.
Yeah, so they have to do it to extend. So if I get my Australian citizen, I'll manage a farm or even buy a farm or something. So.
Fellow student Tony Kim came to Australia from South Korea in 2009 and has been working on a dairy farm in Finlay ever since. Like Justin Moore, he hopes it'll become his permanent home.
Actually, before I came to Australia, I tried to get a permanent visa, such as 457 visa, but Australian government wanted me to get a more qualification about agriculture. I have been worked optical fiber in a broadcast area in Korea for about 9 years, but I didn't know anything about agriculture. So actually I had experience for 2 years in Australia. Australian government wanted me more qualification, higher qualification. So that's why I studying here.
So after the 2 years, is it your hope that the kids in Finlay will sponsor you to stay on their dairy farm?
Yes, hopefully.
Have you discussed this with them?
Yeah. I want to them sponsor me, and hopefully they want me still.
Back in the sheep yards, teacher Jonty Shooter is wrapping up the lesson.
Yeah, just come down here. So I just want to recap what we're doing here and why are we doing
it. Without exception, the international students are all really interested in agriculture. They want to learn, they want to go back into the agricultural field, so they're very highly motivated to do well. And they're a pleasure to be around, actually. They're great people.
And they have skills before they come to these courses. They've worked on farms, they've been up north, or they've even come off farms from their home country.
They have, yeah. It's an interesting cross-section of people. There's one here who has a degree in international relations. We had a student last year who had a degree in business management, and she was off a farm in Ireland. But they all want to go into agriculture in Australia. And so as part of the requirements for becoming a citizen or permanent resident, they need to do training. And so that's one of the reasons why they're here with us, apart from the reason that they want to learn. And they are, as I said, highly motivated to learn.
Agriculture teacher Jonty Shooter from the Riverina Institute of TAFE ending that report on would-be future Aussie farmers from Larissa Smith. I'm Edwina Farley. This is A Country Breakfast on RN. The worry over future food security often doesn't seem real for us in Australia with our plentiful supermarkets, but think back to the banana shortage following Cyclone Larry. Today we're taking a look at how climate change could play havoc with the weekly menu, and we'll get some insights into how future food production can meet our growing appetites.
G'day, it's Michael Cathcart here from Books and Arts. How are you going with your reading of A Fine Balance by Mahinton Mystery? It's this month's title in the Subcontinent Book Club. It's the powerful story of four people who are brought together by the social upheavals of the Indian Emergency. A Fine Balance was shortlisted for the Booker Prize back in 1996, and now it's back. We're discussing it on the final Friday of this month on Books and Arts. I'll talk to you then.
Technology and private investment are the key to producing enough food to feed a growing global population. That's the view of Dr. Alt Dijkhuizen, a leading authority on agriculture and food, most recently briefing the President of China on food safety. He told the National Press Club recently that Australia has a lot to offer, but we don't give agriculture its due credit, especially when it comes to how it could bolster the nation's bottom line. I spoke with him about the future challenges of food security.
When you look backwards, we have realized a doubling of the production also in the last 40, 50 years to do it step by step. And when we are in time and when we use new technology that is already available and when we develop new ones, it is possible, let's say, to increase step by step. And when you do that 2.5% per year, you can double in 40 years.
One of the arguments has been that the fertilisers and so forth that we developed back in the sort of 60s and 70s yeah. produced the kind of growth rates that we can't match again. You don't feel that's a problem?
No, because I think there is quite some new knowledge out. There is quite some new technology coming that helps us that even produce it more precise. So we call it the precision farming or smart farming, where you can realize to produce more with less inputs, to be much more precise in what to do.
So smarter farming rather than just larger scale.
Yeah.
The conversation in this sense often ends up talking about meat and protein in particular. Is meat the devil in the food dilemma, in your opinion?
The difference between a diet with, let's say, efficiently produced meat and a vegetarian diet is much less than often said. So you can say, is that the devil? Well, when you do it in the right way and in an efficient way, the differences are not that big with the more advanced vegetarian meals.
Is it possible to achieve a balance between high production and welfare?
Absolutely. I think the new technology will bring that. You see, when we would have had the old breeds of 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, and we ask from those breeds, with the quality of the management we had at that time, a doubling of the production, that would be really a problem for the animals. But everything is changing. So the type of the animal, the type of the feed, the management, the control you can have, the early detection methods you can have. So you should think of that new environment, and within that new environment, you also can, let's say, improve the animal welfare of the individual animals. So everything will change. That is often, when only one thing would change and the all other parts would remain the same, you would run into problems.
If we look at research, you advocate a model of public-private partnerships, so government funding matched with private funding.
Yeah.
Has that had success in the Netherlands?
Yes, that has had a lot of success. And why? You see, you can define together the priorities. For instance, when you say we need to improve on water management as an example, then where to start and what to do? You need fundamental research. You need already applied research from the technology that's there but not applied enough. And when you combine resources, you can do much more than that one of the stakeholders, the government, is working on one issue and the private industry on another. So when you combine them, when you discuss the targets and when you join forces and also the money, you can make more progress. And we see that in the Netherlands, that is in fact, we always say that is the key factor behind our fast improvement.
The concern though is often put that there are compromises to be made there, that private industry will want different outcomes from government funding. Do you think that's a problem?
No, it's not a problem at all. In you can discuss about it, you can think about it, but in reality, I have never experienced a problem in that. Never.
How about managing the say, competing demands of what the food industry might want in terms of producing things more cheaply, perhaps using different sorts of components in food that's manufactured, and also that push to get back to more real food and food that we know where it's grown and how it's grown and those sorts of things. How do you balance those two?
Yeah, but you see, there is a lot of research already before these questions come in place. When you think of water management or genomics in breeding. There is so much basic knowledge you need to develop before you can think of a commercialized application. And usually joining forces is more in the earlier stage, up to maybe halfway or 80% down to application. And then at the end, there the private industry takes over and make commercial products out of it. But in that earlier stage, you don't have these questions on the table always, or seldomly, I would say.
In Australia, a lot of the agricultural research at the moment is driven through what's called the Cooperative Research Centre model. So that's mostly government funding, but it's also government funding that's every few years. So it's not a long-term funding proposal. How problematic is that?
Yeah, you see, these are all questions in food and agri and in the quality and the soil and the water and the productivity that needs long-term attention, because it are not questions that you can say, well, I can fix them in 2 years or in 3 years and we are done. So I'm very much in favor that you evaluate frequently, because you need to test whether you make progress and enough progress, but it needs longer-term commitments. That is necessary. Otherwise, you won't achieve your goals.
Would you say there's a lot of interest from private companies in investing in agricultural research in Australia in particular?
Well, in general, I would say, because there is almost no sector or industry who can predict that the demand will grow that much in the future. And so there is much more attention of private industry to be part of it. And yes, then they also realize that you need to invest and make it happen. So there is much more attention and interest for investments now than it was 10 years ago.
Why?
Well, they all see a good perspective, because think of it that worldwide, that you need to produce more food. Well, you can also earn a living with that. So everyone also wants to be part in that additional value that is created.
There's money to be made.
There's money to be made. And let's say that's in the worldwide situation. But think of your own country. When people become more wealthy, they have more demands on food. They like to have more special foods, so more what we call added value foods. So there is also a possibility to make money in your own domestic market. And a very important area where consumers are interested in more and more is, for instance, nutrition and health. When you know that certain food is better for your health, or that you can avoid disease problems, well, that has a higher value to you.
You met recently with the president of China as one of the countries that's responsible, in a sense, for the growing demand for food.
Yeah.
What is China's strategy?
He said he was in the Netherlands on a state visit, and you see, the interesting thing is the amount of land per person, per capita, agricultural land, is the same in China as is in the Netherlands. And China has to import at least one-third of their food, or even more. And the Netherlands is able to export 70%, 70, of the food they produce. And he said, how is possible? What can we learn? Because when China could produce a little more, then, that saves them a lot of money. So that was one thing. He needs to have more food for, 1.6 billion people, that's a lot. And secondly, he has a fast-growing middle-class group of people, more wealthy, who have the demand on food safety and on the food quality. So he said, please come and help me, because for me, he said, food security and food quality and safety is priority 1, 2, and 3. So it's really, really, really important in China.
Now, of course, in recent weeks, we've had a food safety scare with hepatitis A. Yeah. Now, that's believed to be linked to a food processing plant in China. So if that's the president's priority, how confident are you that that emphasis will trickle through to food companies themselves?
Oh, yeah, but that will. But it takes time. As I said before, it's not something that you say, okay, I will come next week and we will fix it for you and you are ready. You need to rebuild the system, you need to have here and there other facilities. You need to teach people, because you can put in a new facility, but when people are not able to work with it, it doesn't work either. So it takes a long time, and he also realizes when he starts now to put more emphasis on it that it takes another 10 or 15 years that you really can say, well, we made a big, big improvement. It is not something from 3 to 4 or 5 years.
Dr. Alt Dijkhuizen, the Ambassador for Food Ingredients and Horticulture for the Dutch government. He's also President of Top Sector Agri and Food. That's a Netherlands organisation that draws together government, private industry and universities and research institutes. Now, some of Australia's leading agricultural academics are warning the farming sector needs to act now if it's to cope with a changing climate. A new report has examined the impact hotter temperatures, less rain, more frequent heat waves, and intense cyclones will have on agricultural production around the country. It's found most farming sectors will be worse off and says farmers need to start adapting or change where they farm and what they farm if they're to keep producing food. The report spells out what climate change will mean for everything from oysters to blueberries, wheat crops and wine grapes, and milk and meat production. Professor Richard Eckard heads up the Primary Industries Climate Challenges Centre based at Melbourne University. He's one of the report's authors and says it was a deliberate attempt to drive home the climate change message by linking it to food products.
The idea here was to try and get the discussion out to the general population, to try and engage more people in the discussion about where their food comes from and the struggles that farmers face in producing the commodities required in everyday recipes. To get that into general conversation was the idea.
You describe in the foreword to this report Australian agriculture as being at a turning point. Why do you make that description?
We talk about a turning point. Australia is the most climatically variable country, continent in the world, about 20% more variable than the next nearest continent. Then you've got a signal of climate change on top of that that starts affecting our ability to produce certain commodities. And what we talk about tipping points is things like winter chilling requirements for fruit. It either does or doesn't happen. So there comes a time where it just consistently no longer happens. And so there are some things we can adapt to, but there's some things that actually, when the climate changes, there comes a point where it just doesn't happen anymore and we need to completely change the operation or transform what we do.
And you believe we've reached that sort of critical tipping point for some agricultural products already?
Yes, in some cases we're starting to see those effects. We're starting to see different industries that have now cottoned onto this starting to respond and move coastwards or move further south or to more reliable climates. So we're starting to see that shift happen already.
So this report, it's sort of in two parts, and the first part looks at the different geographical areas of Australia and what the predictions are for climate. The second part looks at specific products, fruit, vegetables, meat, dairy products, and looks at how their production could be affected. What were sort of some of the standout things for you? What are some of the areas of most concern, I guess?
For Northern Australia, we don't have a strong rainfall signal. So there's not a lot we can say about rainfall. All we can really talk about there is the summer rainfall, tropical regions that might experience more heat waves and extreme events. So we're assuming business as usual. It's temperature really and cyclones that we would most be looking at. So temperature extremes, heat waves, that would affect all the industries there. Most of the crops and systems in Northern Australia already cope with high temperature. That's not to say they won't be affected by the extremes, and that's where livestock and some of the mangoes and the avocados and sugarcane can be affected by those extremes. The coastal industries, they're more vulnerable to coastal flooding and cyclones. So the prediction around cyclones is that there might actually be less cyclones, but the category of each cyclone might be higher, and that's disturbing from the point of view of those coastal crops. The biggest signal we see is in southern Australia, where there's definitely a signal for rainfall loss at the margins of the season and heat waves, unseasonal heat waves. And if you couple those two together, that produces some fairly dramatic results. So in some industries, you can adapt to that by just emphasizing the winter production we still have and emphasizing the time of the year when production is more reliable. But other seasons that are more dependent on the margins of the season, yeah, we need to actually, there's some standouts there, for example, in, as I said, in winter chilling and in the ripening of grapes, for example, peak sugar contents, things like that.
Talk me through what some of those standouts were of particularly vulnerable agricultural products.
The livestock industries are particularly vulnerable, particularly to heat stress, unseasonal heat stress. And so whether they're housed or whether they're grazing out in the field, that heat stress is a real issue for them. In housing, obviously, we can manage it in some way, but when they're out grazing in the field, there's not a lot we can do about providing them with shade or shelter. They're just providing good drinking water. Having access to drinking water is really important.
And the dairy industry, what sort of things do you see when there are heat waves?
So for dairy, for example, milk production is a very sensitive indicator to the nutritional status of the animal, but also to the environment it's in. A few years ago in November, we had a heat wave in particularly northern Victoria, and we saw milk production just crash. And so heat stress has a very real and immediate impact on the dairy industry and its ability to recover from that. So those cows not only crash in their production, but they don't recover very readily, and they very seldom get back up to the peak levels of milk production they were at beforehand.
Just to the winter chilling, what effect does that have on fruit production, and which particular fruits are the worst affected?
So winter chilling is a feature where certain temperate nuts and fruits, particularly pome and stone fruit, apples and pears, require a certain number of hours in winter below a certain threshold temperature, but above zero. And if they don't get that cumulative number of hours below a certain temperature, they just do not go reproductive. In other words, you will get either inferior fruit development or no fruit development. What we're finding is there's some areas that used to get those cold temperatures consistently through winter, but now they're no longer getting that as consistently as they used to.
Which areas are those?
Mainly up in northern Victoria, we'd see the Goulburn Valley, those areas there that that may or may not get those chilling requirements, whereas, for example, in Tasmania, they still get cold enough and stay cold enough for long enough to get those.
How can agriculture adapt, and how is it adapting in Australia? Are we sort of doing it quickly enough?
Well, at this stage, farmers can only respond to what they see, you know, the conditions they encounter. So for research, we've got to develop the options for them to move to when they need to move to those options. Right now, if they're not facing that immediate need to change. So there's some areas, for example, if you're no longer getting winter chilling, you need to think about either changing to another system or move to another area. Others is just a case of re-emphasizing where we place our emphasis in the production system. So if you're getting reliable pasture growth in winter, we'll just focus on the winter period, and the margins of the season are less reliable. So it just changes sometimes the internal system we look at, but other times it has to be transformative.
What is the uncertainty around national policy at the moment in Australia for renewables and climate policy? Is that having an impact on that planning that you talk about in agriculture about working out where we go next?
I think there's definitely an impact in the availability of emphasis on research and extension, advice to the farmers about what the options are. So we definitely need emphasis on research, but not research just on climate change. This is research that integrates a climate signal into managing and coping with the variable environment that we live in. So it's about sending that signal that there are things that can be done that continue to make us profitable in agriculture. And then the other side of it is the extension and education continually rolling out to agriculture to say, well, here's some things we already know that can be adopted. And I think there's not enough emphasis on either of those at the moment to be providing us with the options we're going to need by 2020 and 2040, 2050.
Do you think agriculture as a sector has fully appreciated and grasped that it is at that really pointy end of climate change?
Look, I think we've seen a shift over the last few years from initially when we started talking about climate change, there was quite a lot of resistance. And I think we've now passed that. I think there's a large group of farmers that are recognising that things are changing. We don't really attribute that to anything in particular, but there is the climate is changing and there's a need to change how we farm to adapt to that. So whether we attribute it to human-induced climate change or whether we say this is a cycle or whatever, probably doesn't matter right now. What matters is, are we responding to the conditions we're seeing and responding to the trends that are happening?
And that's Professor Richard Eckard from the University of Melbourne speaking with Kath McAloon. That report was produced in conjunction with the World Wildlife Fund for Earth Hour 2015. And that's it from A Country Breakfast this week. Thanks to Brendan O'Neill for technical production. Don't forget to join me on Twitter at Edwina Farley to talk all things food and stay up to date with the latest news via our webpage, abc.net.au/rural. Stay listening to RN.